And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is G Captain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of G Captain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles, and in the studio with me is Captain John Conrad. We are your hosts. Welcome, John. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
All right. This broadcast is for the week of July 1st, 2013. Listeners, this is the place we bring you the latest news and happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. We have some interesting things to share with you today. Today we'll be talking about, first off, a ship that we referenced last week, the MOL Comfort. A ship that broke in half. We had two halves of that ship floating in the water. Apparently one half of it went down. We'll also be talking about pirates in the Gulf of Guinea. And if we have time, we'll talk about the IMO, which, John, is what, the International
Maritime Organization.
Okay, so we'll be talking, if we have time, about the International Maritime Organization and their annual Day of the Seafarer and what they're up to. So let's get right into it, John. The MOL Comfort is a ship that we talked about last week, a rather large ship, if I recall, almost 1,000 feet or a little over 1,000 feet?
A little over 1,000.
So a big ship. Broke in half, a clean break, and we had both the front half and the back half floating in the water.
Correct.
And now we only have one half floating in the water.
Yes.
Okay, so what happened? This thing, half of it went down.
The stern section, it very clean break, it broke almost right in the center in two neat pieces, and they've got salvage tugs out attempting to tow it. They were able to get the bow section under tow, and they were trying to get the stern section, but the stern section just sank.
So I would imagine, obviously, the watertight bulkheads were keeping this portion of the stern buoyant and above water, but the stability must have been very, what would we say, treacherous or very touchy at that point, trying to get that thing underway when you've only got a bow section of the ship.
Yeah, absolutely. The ship is made to float with the entire ship, and you take off a huge section, there's going to be major problems. Now, the other problem here is most of the fuel oil. They used heavy fuel oil was in the aft section, according to these reports, plus the engine room and a significant 1,700 containers. So this fuel oil, 1,700 containers, the engine room, the accommodations is all now on the bottom of the ocean, 13,000 feet of water.
Wow. Okay. So it didn't go down in shallow water either. So that is obviously going to be a big problem. So now this goes from a what would have been initially sort of a reclaiming operation. It wasn't quite in the salvage stage yet, I suppose. But this is now an operation where they're going to have to go down and try and, do you think they'll try and bring the whole thing back up? Or what will happen now?
No, this is too deep of water. It is possible. In the aviation community, wherever the plane goes down, they try to bring the entire plane up and reconstruct. But even in the largest maritime disasters, you have to look at the deepwater horizon, the worst environmental disaster in the history of the world. Do you know the BP oil rig, after it exploded and went down to the bottom? But the government did the entire report, and there has never been a picture released to the public of the deepwater horizon at the bottom of the ocean. And that was only in 10,000 feet of water. They could have rose, if that was an aviation industry, they would have salvaged it, brought it up, reconstructed a warehouse, and done forensic analysis to figure out what exactly, they know a lot of what caused the BP oil rig to explode, but they would have learned a lot more if they brought it up. But they also would have learned a lot more if they had taken pictures of that rig, and they didn't even do that. It's simply, the public doesn't demand it, and it's not typical. So I expect that this is, unfortunately, the last that we have seen of the MOL Comfort's stern.
Well, I wonder if, you mentioned there are a number of containers on there. I wonder if salvage operations, if it would be worth, well, of course, they would be soaked at this point, wouldn't they? They would all be waterlogged.
Correct.
But I'm just wondering out loud here, thinking with you out loud, if it would be worth some type of salvage operation to go down and start bringing that stuff up.
Well, these are very expensive operations. There was a flight a few years ago going from Paris to Brazil. It went down, and I think it was 12,000 feet of water, and it's one of the most expensive salvage operations in the history of the world. And they're going and they're trying to find the black box. Now, this is another question. The ships in the last few years have been mandated. All ships now are required to have a bridge audio recorder. This is critical information to find out what happened in the last moments of any disaster.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this brings to mind the Concordia, because we had the recordings off that, didn't we?
Yes, we sure did.
So, and that's how we had those recordings, is due to that black box?
Correct. There are microphones on the bridge, and it's relayed up to a unit that it's stored on a hard drive in a watertight container up on the flying bridge that automatically releases and can be recovered. Now, we don't even know in this particular instance if the bridge recorder was salvaged, you know, if the crew brought it out with them when they got rescued, or if it's now, hopefully, when it sunk, even if it was still, hopefully they recovered. And if it sank, it flew free and we got a hold of it, but we're not certain.
It just brings to my mind EPIRBs. I do know enough about the maritime industry to know what an EPIRB is, emergency position indicating radio beacon, right?
You got it.
And the way those are situated on top of the ships, because when I was a merchant seaman for 2 years out of college, as we've shared, and on those vessels, I remember the EPIRBs up top and positioned, and they would be self-deploying as well, obviously.
Yes.
So if something happened and the ship went down, those would float, just as the big canister lifeboats do. I'm surprised that these black boxes aren't situated in a similar fashion.
They are. That's exactly how they are.
Well, good. Well, I was on the right track there, John.
Yes. And that's one piece of the puzzle, because we'll get some indication of, you know, the type of weather and what the crew was saying and what they were observing. You know, we'll have a play-by-play of what they were observing in the moments before, if there were any unusual stresses, what their worries were, they knew. So this is critical information, and we don't know if it's recovered. But more importantly, the big question on this incident that everyone's asking is, was it a container weight issue?
Mm-hmm.
So the only ports, as we said last week, the only ports that weigh containers are on the east coast of the U.S., and those are for longshoremen compensation. And they only weigh them when they come off the vessel. No containers are weighed prior to going on the vessel. So the shipping company or the warehouse that's shipping these parts writes out a manifest and declares how much they weigh, but that information isn't verified. So there have been a number of small container ships that are less stable that have flipped over while still tied to the pier because of this problem. So it's a well-known problem. We just haven't seen it affect a vessel of this size before. So they were hoping by recovering all the containers that when they brought them into port, we'd be able to weigh them and determine exactly if this is the major issue or not. Now that opportunity is completely lost.
So there, with regard to the containers and their weights, it appears obviously there's a lack of check and balances.
Yes.
With regard to confirming their weights. So if we get a hold of this black box and there seems to be nothing out of the ordinary, they're not screaming about 75-foot rogue wave coming their way, that everything seems to be ordinary, it really does seem to point to the potential of this weight issue with these containers then, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's been the focus of GCAPM articles. But we're working on another exclusive here. We had a experienced ship captain. He's a well-known pilot. I don't want to share his name because some of this information is incriminating to the industry.
Mm.
But he said that the container weights will exacerbate a problem, but there has to be a problem with the hull structure. And the World Wildlife Federation last week, it's another top article on GCAPTAIN, did an investigation of all the reasons ships are lost at sea. And a full 50% of those ships are lost to structural damage. And unless there was a huge rogue wave here, which seems very unlikely for a number of reasons, there had to have been some structural, even with the cargo container weights being off, there had to have been some structural issues. The ship should have survived there.
Mm-hmm.
And this pilot gave me a book that was published a few years ago by a ship owner, a guy inside this club who had access to all the information that we don't normally hear about.
Mm-hmm.
He owned the largest tankers in the world. And after retiring from that, he has an interesting story. He was actually a professor at MIT and then became a ship owner, bought the largest tankers in the world. And then after retiring, moved to Florida and he wrote a book exposing all these industry secrets. Mm-hmm. And he didn't publish it with a well-known publisher. He published it online using open source, free software, just as a PDF. And no one's heard of this book. And I started reading it the other day. It's called The Tromedy. And we'll have links in the show notes. And this book really exposes some fundamental issues with how ships are built and inspected. And this pilot who recommended the book and the book itself really questions whether container weights were the major issue or if there were larger structural problems in this vessel design.
And that begs a lot of questions, but I want to back up. Repeat the name of the book for me, please.
The book is called The Tromedy, and it's an unusual name. But it's supposed to be a hybrid of tragedy and comedy. Tromedy, T-R-O-M-E-D-Y.
Okay. And you mentioned you'll provide a link. So how can listeners get to this book if they want to browse through it?
We will have a link in the show notes, absolutely.
So this may then open up some type of issue in the shipbuilding industry, maybe cutting corners, maybe, I wouldn't think it would be in design, but obviously in the actual construction then of these vessels.
Well, the question here is, this ship is only 5 years old.
Yeah, new.
So why would a relatively new ship experience these stresses and crack in half? And this book by Jack Devaney, it's really eye-opening, but he points to a number of problems. One is the classification societies. So in order to get a vessel insured, it has to be inspected by a classification society, ABS, DMV, or some of the best ones. This vessel was inspected by Class NK, a Japanese classification society. These classification societies are very good. They have the technical competence, and their inspectors are great. But the ship owners hire the class. So the ship owners are paying the bill. But even scarier than that, the shipyards also have to hire. So the shipyards pick which class they want to. And in this case, the classification, the ship was built in Japan by Mitsubishi Shipyards, and it's classed by a Japanese classification. And the more that the shipyards business have, the more business this classification society has had.
Yep, I can see where this is going.
So the question really is, with the price of commodities now, and you're the real expert in this conversation, so I hope you can enlighten us a little bit, but the price of commodities has really skyrocketed in the last 10 years. The price to cost to build a ship hasn't changed much in terms of labor and other expenses, but the steel in the ship. This is the factor that Jack Devaney really keys in on, that a well-built, you can use all the computer designs and all the new processes you want, but those are only going to be able to make ships cheaper, to make ships safer, and to prevent them from breaking in half, they need more steel.
Mm-hmm.
And that steel has to be well-coated, and the ship has to be inspected. Now, every 5 years since steel was used on ships, it's been well known that 5 years is the longest that new steel can go to be uninspected. After 5 years, you run the risk of rust causing serious structural damage. Well, this incident happened at the five-year mark. So every 5 years, a ship has to be brought into dry dock and completely inspected. The steel has to be thickness checked.
Mm-hmm.
So this ship was just about to go. It hadn't gone yet.
Oh, boy.
So with the price of steel being so high, we've used all these computer design and things to reduce the amount of steel to within safe limits.
Right.
But what are safe limits? And is 5 years a long enough period with these reduced steel thicknesses?
Very interesting. Well, and it brings up two things in my mind. As you know, as the listeners may not know, my background is in finance and economics. So I'm an investment manager by trade and have a degree in finance and extensive study in economics, the field of economics. So the first thing that this really reminds me of, I think that most people here domestically in the United States can relate to, is the mortgage bubble. And a lot of that was caused in a similar relationship here between rating agencies and the issuers of the product. So with regard to the mortgage bubble, the rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and a couple other large ones, we're basically on the dole on the pay roster of the investment banks that were receiving these ratings from them. So there was a bit of certainly, if it wasn't outright implied, collusion going on between the institutions that were supposed to be, in essence, the watchdogs, the rating agencies, and those that were providing the product, or in this case, the mortgages or these pooled mortgages. And so they'd give them these AAA or AA ratings when, did they really deserve them? Who knows, but they wanted the gravy train to continue to flow. So in this situation here with the shipping industry, I see a real analogy with that, where the manufacturers have a relationship with the, did you call them certification agencies or?
Classification.
Classification. With the classification societies. Obviously, it's a hand-in-glove relationship, and there's opportunity there for conflict of interest. So that's something that really, I don't know, in the international arena, which shipbuilding is, I don't know what agency or what governing body would be able to examine that and tighten up those rules. Obviously, here in the United States, we had Congress look severely at the rating agencies. In the international shipbuilding arena, I don't know who would be able to do that, but it certainly would work.
It's the International Maritime Organization, but we're going to, a little later in this podcast, talk about the problems we're experiencing there.
Which I gather you may not be the largest fan of, so yeah.
But here, and it's interesting, the class inspectors are some of the most competent and intelligent people, and really bribery. It still exists in class societies in some African ports and some third world nations, but in places like Japan, the U.S., you know, in my 15 years on board ships, I've never seen a bribe. I've never seen the individual inspectors, and these guys really care. And a lot of our listeners are class inspectors, so I don't want to belittle their efforts. They're the first line of defense, really, against these tragedies. But at the higher levels of class, a big problem is that these ships are constantly, they have contracts. They have to meet those contracts. Things happen where dates have to be moved back. And the classification societies are very willing at higher levels, higher than the inspector levels, to say, okay, we'll postpone that inspection for 6 months, postpone it for a year. We'll allow you time to fix these problems. So by the time a inspection is postponed and then the grace period of getting any problems fixed and so forth, these vessels are really allowed a period of time where they could potentially be unsafe and still allowed to sail. Now, this vessel particularly was due its five-year inspection on the 13th of this month, so it was overdue for inspection. Now, it was only overdue a week or two, not a significant amount of time, but why are we allowing these when we know that a ship can break up due to rust at a five-year period? The other thing about these grace periods are they don't require a cursory inspection a lot of times. Mm-hmm. If we have to allow a grace period, we should send an inspector out to approve that. Mm-hmm. But right now they're getting approved at the higher levels of the class. And that's potentially very dangerous.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And maybe one of these days we could get a classification inspector on the show with us, do a call-in interview. That would be very interesting to get that perspective. And one other quick comment from an economic standpoint, you know, the manufacturing of the steel, manufacturing of things like steel and cement and other finished commodities has escalated over the last several decades in the Asian Rim countries, whereas a lot of that manufacturing prior was done here in the United States that arguably had much higher standards and levels of oversight from our government agencies. As a matter of fact, ironically, that's one of the reasons why a lot of this production has moved offshore. So it could be argued, we'd have to certainly do some research, but it could be argued that because of a more lax regulatory environment for producing these finished manufacturing goods like steel or concrete, it's resulting in a lesser quality product. And now we're seeing some disasters such as this. So it's speculation, but it's not too far of a stretch to connect those dots.
And there are vast numbers of different grades of steel that have, you know, you could build a ship entirely out of stainless steel, and this wouldn't happen, but that would be expensive. So the grade of steel it's all put into a computer program, and then they put in the coatings, you know, what the rust is prevented by painting the steel, but there are different grades of coatings, and all that is put in a computer program, and it spits out, this is what you need. But that's the minimum.
Right.
You know, they're not going to put more steel because it's so expensive.
Sure. Yeah, makes sense. Okay. Very, very interesting stuff, John. Well, let's move on. Well, let me ask you, is there anything else that you want to comment with regard to the comfort and manufacture before we move on to our next subject?
Well, we're really hoping now that the bow section makes it to port, and we've lost half of the forensic evidence, but what we're really hoping for and what GCAM is calling for is that black box is recovered, that bow section is brought into port, all these containers are offloaded and weighed. This is something some people in the industry are fighting against, but you know, this is something we're pushing on GCAPTAIN, and we hope all of you push as well. These containers are weighed, and that we get some real expert inspectors to inspect this tank and the exact area where it's
sheared. Yeah, very good. Excellent.
Let's measure the steel and see how thick it was in this area.
Yeah, see if we can help with this cause of figuring out exactly what happened and keeping our seas safer. All right, moving on to pirates in the Gulf of Guinea. What the heck's going on over there?
So the big piracy area for years was the Malacca Straits, right off of Singapore. So when you're bringing goods from Japan or all of Asia through to the Gulf of Aden, you got to go past Singapore through the Malacca Straits. And it's called what the Navy calls a choke point. All these ships come from different areas and they choke into this small waterway. And it gives the pirates a good opportunity. But Malaysia and Indonesia has been put a lot of resources into their Coast Guard and fighting these pirates. And it was largely successful. And they had fairly well solved the problem. There's still piracy in there, but it's more really theft. And I worked there for a while. I was in a ship that was laid up across from Singapore for 6 months. And the authorities respond quickly. And the pirates there are really just looking to steal mooring lines, brass fixtures, and stuff like that. Not hijack entire ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Somalia. And now, once Malacca was kind of fixed, Somalia burst out. And we all know what's happening there, this hijacking and everything else. Well, ship owners reluctantly started putting security teams on board and have fixed these problems. I mean, the solution is you need guys who are well-trained on board to fight these pirates.
Right.
And you need a quick Navy response time. So all the major maritime countries have naval assets in the area. All of the ships have security teams and operations and procedures in place to avoid these pirates. It's been highly effective. Just in the last year, the amount of ships taken over by pirates in Somalia has sunk to lows we haven't seen in years.
Really? And do you know what maybe the most effective methodology is? I know for a while it seemed a little silly when I would see them with the fire hoses spraying water at the pirates when they'd come up to the boats. I suppose it would work a little, but it always seemed, I don't know, it seemed like carrying a knife to a gunfight to
sure.
me. So what do you think has been the responsible factor for the significant decline over the last 18 months or so?
A number of things. The Navy can't respond in time to help, so it's really up to the ship owners. And what's really working for the ship owners is making it hard to get on the vessel. So they're putting razor wire around the vessels, putting automated sprinkler systems and using other techniques to make it more difficult for the pirates to get on board the ship. But it really comes down to the security teams. And these guys, a lot of them are former special forces. They come on with weapons. And when the pirates come close, they see that these ships are armed. And many of them turn around and some of them continue to approach. And we've seen physical altercations where, you know, bullets have been exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the reason these security teams work. But it's not just the guns these guys carry. It's the extra set of eyes. If you can see a pirate ship and identify a pirate vessel, the more time you have to take evasive action, get all your gear together, prepare for to be attacked, the safer you're going to be. And with the crew sizes so small,
right?
You know, you have between 15 and 20 guys on these ships. maybe only one on the bridge who's actually looking out, and he has some other navigational duties at times.
Yep.
So these extra security teams are guys standing there with binoculars. And it's the binoculars more than guns. I don't want to underemphasize the need for guns.
Mm-hmm.
You need to fight fire with fire, and that's proven effective. But the binoculars are just as effective in stopping these pirates as the guns.
So they allow for the preparedness as opposed to allowing the pirates to have the complete element of surprise.
Yeah, you only have a few minutes from when that ship is seen till they attack.
Yeah.
And just an extra 60, 90 seconds of lead time really gives you the opportunity just to make sure the guns aren't cleared and the razor wire and start taking maneuvering action.
Yeah, I could see that, certainly. I mean, you've spent plenty of time out at sea. I've spent a little bit of time out at sea, and I could certainly see the difference between trying to fend somebody off that's 30 feet down, you know, 30 or 40 feet below you in the water, as opposed to somebody walking along the deck pointing a gun at your head.
Makes a big difference.
Big difference, sure. But what else with the piracy situation there?
Well, this is the solution, these onboard security teams to piracy in Somalia, and it's working. It's having a major effect. But now the pirates in West Africa are using a lot of the techniques of the Somali pirates, and they're copying them, and they're innovating on these techniques, and piracy right now is exploding in the Gulf of Guinea, off of the coast of Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. And that's on the western side of Africa,
correct?
Yes. And what sounds interesting to me about the title of the article from gcaptain.com is that the African states are coordinating here. They're joining together and working together. Is this true?
Yes. So there are Navy vessels from every single major maritime country in the Indian Ocean on the east side of Africa. But there is not one vessel that is specifically there for anti-piracy duties, a military vessel on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And there is no support from the major navies on this East Coast. So it's leaving this major gap of opportunity that the countries in East Africa are trying to close this gap by banding together and trying to solve the problem. But before we start sending navies and spending a lot of taxpayer dollars, we need to do what works, and that is start allowing these security teams on board the vessels.
Very interesting. You know what, John? We're just about at the end of our 30 minutes already.
Goes quickly.
Time flies when you're having fun. So let's wrap up this subject about piracy. We're not going to be able to talk about the IMO today because I know you've got some distinct opinions on that. So we'll save that for next week. So final thoughts with regard to the piracy situation.
We know it works. We know the security teams work, and having naval vessels with a few hour response time works. The pirates in Nigeria are copying what the pirates in Somalia are doing. We need to copy what the ship owners and the navies in Somalia are doing and stamp that into Nigeria. That's the solution.
Makes sense. Take a winning formula, a winning solution, and reapply it.
The pirates are doing it. Why aren't we doing it?
Right.
That's the question.
That's right. Very good. Excellent. Okay. Well, listeners, we thank you for spending this time with us. John, any closing thoughts?
This has been a real busy week. GCAP hit 2 million page views.
Wow.
Which really high watermark and a lot of great stories. So go into the archives of GCAP, check out the forums, and a lot of good stuff this week.
Congratulations. Over 2 million page views. Good. Onward and upward. Continued growth.
We hit iTunes. So in the show notes, this URL, you're going to be able to subscribe to this radio show via iTunes. So we'll have the link.
Good. So for all the Apple users out there, they can subscribe to this and they'll be notified every time a show comes up.
It'll be automatically downloaded to their iTunes on their computer, their iPhone, their iTablet, iPad, any iDevice.
Okay. You can tell I'm not an Apple guy, so I've got to ask these questions. Okay, excellent. Well, listeners, thank you for being with us. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week to keep up with what's going on in the maritime and offshore industry. On behalf of John Conrad and myself, Jeff Eccles, we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Be well and be safe.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. GCaptain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.